There are a large number of people who think that it's worth buying a house as an investment and not even bothering to put a renter in. That means that you make an even bigger loss, so you can claim more in negative gearing. But they're banking on such a large increase in capital gain that they don't even have to bother putting a renter in.
One for mum, one for dad, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and today we're talking housing affordability with Matt Grudnoff, our Senior Economist, and Rod Campbell, our Director of Research. If you're slogging it out to real estate open days every weekend, you'll know just how ridiculous the housing market has become.
Home ownership, the great Australian dream. Now, streets away for most of us.
For the second call at $4,300,000 now, third and final call at $4,300,000.
Our housing market is probably the most insane in the Western world, hands down, period.
And it's not just for people wanting to buy. Renters too are really struggling to find anything affordable. Anglicare's recent annual rental affordability index, for example, shows that of 67,000 properties surveyed around the country, less than 1% were affordable for those earning the minimum wage. So just ahead of the 2017 federal budget, the government has finally acknowledged that housing affordability is a problem.
Because housing affordability in this country is something that's very, very important.
The closer the federal budget gets, the more intense the political rhetoric on housing affordability.
The government looks set to replace jobs and growth with bricks and mortar.
So the idea was floated that first-time buyers should be allowed to dip into their superannuation savings to help them pay for their first home.
A controversial proposal to allow young Australians to put their superannuation savings to their first home.
Under the proposal, young people could have their superannuation contributions placed in a special account for 3 years to help save for a deposit.
There's a lot of merit in the concept.
If people would prefer to use it to put down a deposit on a home, why not?
My own view is that it would be a thoroughly bad idea.
Matt, how was this idea received?
Well, I think amongst experts it was received universally, as in they all thought it was a really horrible idea. And that's probably because...
What do experts know?
Probably because it really is such a horrible, horrible idea. We know from the First Home Buyers Grant that whenever you hand out cash to one group in the housing market, all it does is benefit the person selling the house. So if people show up to the auction with more money in their wallets, then they just bid the price up even higher. In fact, one academic study found that the $7,000 first home buyer grant actually increased median house prices by $57,000.
Whoa.
So it didn't help first home buyers really at all. All it did was help people who owned the kind of houses that first home buyers wanted to buy.
Yeah, I mean, if you're pushing more money into the housing market, you can expect the prices to go up. It's not really that hard.
So if you think about it from a young person's perspective, let's say they managed to get into the market, they're going to get into a market that's gone even higher and so is even more likely to crash at a later point. They've destroyed their super, and we know from compound interest that the early savings are the ones that are going to make you the most. So they've got little super, and now they own a precarious asset that's way overvalued. We're setting them up to fail later in life if we do this.
So that's part of the reason why you think that's a terrible idea. But I just want to unpack this policy idea about dipping into your super in a few other ways. It struck me that it's a bit of a sexist policy because women quite often have less super than men saved up. But also, when you're a young person, sometimes you're flicking between jobs. Do you even have much super to dip into in the first place?
Can we take out the euphemism here? Let's not go with dipping into our super.
Clearing out?
You might just sort of dip into the ocean and dip out, like taking money out of super.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah, look, I mean, you're right. Young people don't have as much super. They haven't been in the market for as long. Their wage rates are generally lower. They're more likely to be in casual type wages. And what we've learnt just recently is they're likely to be underpaid on their super. But even if they're getting all their super, there's still not likely to be a huge amount of super. So if we take what little super they have and they shove it into a house, all we're going to really do is beat up the price of houses.
And have a bunch of people who end up on the pension in retirement because they don't have enough superannuation, presumably.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I mean, we've got to understand that, I mean, people have been saying we're in a housing bubble for quite some time. And I think bubble's a bad word because it sort of conjures up, it happens really quick and then it pops. But really...
Can I do it again?
What a bubble is when the, you know, when things like wages get out of sync with house prices, and the longer this happens and the more out of sync they become, then the more chance you are of something happening and house prices falling. So last year we saw wages rise by about 2%, maybe a little bit less. We saw house prices on average across Australia rise by about 10%. In Sydney they were up 19%, and in Melbourne they were up 16%. So we've got house prices in Sydney rising by almost 20% and wages being almost 2%, so 10 times faster than wages.
And what about that group that we hear so much about, the mum and dad investors? How will this impact them, if at all?
Well, I mean, I don't see the significance of mum and dad investors. By the time you've got enough money in this society to actually invest, you probably are a mum and dad by that stage. What we're saying is at the moment, because of the tax incentives that we put in place, and we'll probably talk about them more in a sec, but because of the tax incentives we put in place, investing in property is the best place to invest. You get the best tax refunds, you get the best tax concessions if you invest in residential property. So what do people do? Well, lots of people invest in residential property to the point where if you look at the prices of housing, we have overinvestment in residential property. But residential property is not the only thing that people can invest in. It's not like mums and dads are out there and they have one option. They can either put it in a bank account or invest in residential property. There's a whole gamut of things they could invest in, the share market, business, all sorts of things.
I've got an emu farm they could invest in.
Emu farms, exactly right. So it's not about disadvantaging mum and dad investors. We just want people not to invest in residential property. We'd want them to invest in other more productive things within the economy, and certainly not over-invest in any particular asset.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but basically this policy to allow people to clear out their super for their first home, really what you're saying is the benefits
clear out their super. Ebony's not just dipping into it, she's clearing it out.
But the benefits are going to accrue to people who already own property, and it's not really going to help anyone who's trying to break into that market, is it?
Well, I mean, they'll get into the market, but they'll get into a massively inflated market, and this policy will increase house prices. And so, you know, if you're selling a house, particularly the kind of house that a first home buyer is interested in buying in, then this is a great policy for you. If you're a young person, it's a really bad policy.
It's not clear if the Coalition will drop or pursue this idea of raiding super savings to pay for housing, but the debate has again put the spotlight on negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount, with renewed calls to scrap these tax concessions.
Any housing affordability plan which doesn't involve reform to negative gearing is a sham.
They know that if they want to resuscitate the Australian dream of owning your own home, they need to act on negative gearing.
Curbs on negative gearing, absolutely, wind it back.
What's causing the overinvestment in residential property is two things, negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount. Everybody talks about negative gearing. It's the poster boy of increasing demand for housing. Because house prices are so high, people are making losses when they invest in residential property. Negative gearing simply means that the government picks up some of that loss at tax time, so you get a bigger refund. You're able to write those losses off. But the other big one that people don't talk about as much, and I would argue is actually even more important than negative gearing, is the capital gains tax discount. Now, the capital gains tax discount simply means that You can earn money from wages, from rent, from interest in bank accounts, and you pay a certain amount of tax on that. If you earn money from when you make a capital gain, that is, you sell something for more than you bought it for, you actually pay half as much tax on that than on any other form of income. Half as much tax on a capital gain. Why? I have no idea. What is so special about people who earn money from a capital gain? From an economist's point of view, income earned from a capital gain is probably the least productive way. If you go out there and work, you produce something, all the other ways of producing income are actually productive. Capital gain is a passive investment, and so therefore it's particularly unproductive. But for some reason, we want to tax this at half the rate.
Half the rate. I mean, Matt, you're talking about all capital gains, but remember that on your main residence, you don't pay capital gains tax at all.
That's exactly right. On your own home, you pay no capital gains tax at all. So it's only half the rate on investment properties and shares and all the other things that you get a capital gain on.
That's sometimes called the family home. You know,
for mum and dad investors.
Should you have capital gains tax on the family home? And if you're saying family capital gains tax family home, you're one of those dipping into the super sort of people. It's a euphemism. Your house is a serious asset in Australia. Your main residence is a serious asset, and in my view, it should certainly be taxed as an asset.
Well, just as someone who works for a living and doesn't get their income from capital gains...
And it doesn't own a house.
And doesn't own a house. It does
or poverty
like,
for you in retirement.
Or a home, for that matter.
Oh, my poor little apartment. She'll be stressed. But it does strike me as odd that we would treat that type of income so differently from, a cleaner working... 45 hours a week for minimum wage kind of thing. Like, what makes it so special?
That's a very, very good question, and one that's actually quite difficult to answer. It's never been fully explained.
It's the great Australian dream.
It was brought in by Costello and Howard in 1999, and just after that, we saw a massive increase in investment in residential property. So really, it was the capital gains tax discount that sparked all of this. It was claimed that it would actually pay for itself. Howard and Costello actually claimed that it would pay for itself because it would encourage more investment. Now, that's been thoroughly debunked, obviously, over the last 10 or 15 years. But basically, it was a bit like the corporate tax cut. If you say it's going to help business or it's going to increase investment, then
it's going to trickle down
and people believe it. But
trickle, damn you!
But really, this is a massive concession for the rich. And let's be clear, 75% of the capital gains tax discount goes to the top 10% of income earners in Australia. There are a few things that are more unequally spread. Even negative gearing is more equally spread than the capital gains tax discount.
Others still seek to oversimplify the issue, promising Australians they'd all be able to buy a house all just by changing one tax. It's not only wrong, it's not only dangerous policy for our economy. I actually think it's cynical and I think it's cruel.
Bill Shorten's policy is calculated to reduce the value of your home.
Well, Sydney does have amazing housing crisis. Prices are up, supply is down.
The government has unequivocally ruled out doing anything about capital gains tax discount or negative gearing tax concessions in the budget. So the next big battle cry in the housing affordability debate is going to be about increasing the supply of housing. But will that actually help to bring down the cost of new houses?
Well, we hear about supply being a very important factor, and it is. If you increase supply, you could lower or decrease the rate of increase of house prices. But I think we mostly hear about it from the federal government because supply is wholly a state issue. So if you're a federal government that wants to do nothing but look like you're doing something about rising house prices, then the best thing you can do is talk about supply, because what you're effectively saying is it's not my problem, it's the states, they're stuffing up, we don't have to do anything.
And Rod, you were talking to me a little bit earlier about vacancies in terms of supply. What's the issue there?
There's a great study that's done by a group called Prosper Australia most years, I think they do it, that looks at what sort of percentage of Australia's housing, or I think they look mainly at Melbourne's housing, is actually vacant. People own it, but nobody lives in it. And they reckon it's about 5%. And they base that on water usage data that they get from the utilities, where they're provided the number of properties that use zero or some very small amount of water. And they assume that any property that uses basically zero water is unoccupied for the year.
Hey, what about that demographic of people who don't wash and just drink beer? You just drink beer and you don't wash?
Hidden in the figures they are.
and just get takeout food.
I'm not like that anymore, Matt. There's a lot of housing supply in Australia that could be unlocked if we changed some of our regulations that make owning a house and gambling on its capital value so worthwhile that people will leave properties vacant. There's plenty we can do there if we're interested in supply and bringing more houses onto the market.
And this is a really, really important issue that highlights exactly where the problem is. Let's be clear, there are a large number of people who think that it's worth buying a house as an investment and not even bothering to put a renter in. Okay, so what does that mean? That means that you make an even bigger loss, so you can claim more in negative gearing. But they're banking on such a large increase in capital gain that they don't even have to bother putting a renter in. Why put a renter in? All they do is scuff up the place and, you know, wear it down.
Value.
Exactly,
yeah, right.
It's
resale value.
You know, sure, they might pay $300 or $400 a week, but it's going to go up in price so much and so quickly that it's not even worth putting a renter in. And basically, Scott Morrison, in his recent speech, effectively said that when he said something quite extraordinary. It was both extraordinary and a statement of the blindingly obvious. But when politicians sometimes say the blindingly obvious, it's actually quite helpful. He said, Australian residential property investment is more geared to capital gain than yield. Now, what does that mean? It basically means that people who decide to invest in housing are looking for the capital gain at the end, not the amount of rent they get at the time. So what he's effectively saying is that we are a bunch of property speculators. We're not in it in order to provide a house and get a return on that house year on year. We're in it because we know it's going to go up in price one day, and when we sell it, we're going to sell it for a lot more. And that's why the capital gains tax discount, which halves the amount of tax we pay on that gain, and negative gearing, which help us cover the loss over time, are so important in this issue.
My understanding is that the population splits pretty neatly into thirds. About a third of Australians own their own house outright. About a third of Australian households are paying off a mortgage, and about a third of Australian households are renting. You know, that, to some extent, explains the political forces at play here when you've got basically two-thirds of people who don't want their house price to go down and one-third of people who do. Kind of explains why Scott Morrison is really interested in talking about Australia's property market being directed towards capital gain, because a lot of people do want that.
And even more so, if you look at negative gearing by electorate, you find that it is electorates like the Prime Minister's in Wentworth and the Treasurer's, Scott Morrison's, and mostly Liberal, the top ones are mostly Liberal electorates. So the government represents the people who do the most negative gearing.
Is that numbers of houses negatively geared?
That's the value of the loss, so yeah, the value of the deduction going to these people. And Liberal Party electorates lose more and therefore get a larger deduction in negative gearing than Labor or National Party electorates. So it's not surprising that the Liberal Party hear every day from their constituents who are saying, no, don't change negative gearing, no, don't change the capital gains tax discount.
So not only are they relying on a big capital gain, but they're using it to massively reduce their tax in the meantime.
That's exactly right.
It's one of Richard's lines that it costs the government a lot of money to make housing this expensive.
Yeah, it costs the government around $10 billion a year to make housing this unaffordable. And that's basically the value of the capital gains tax discount and the cost of negative gearing to the budget. If we got rid of both of those, not only would house prices slow down and housing over time become more affordable, but we would also save $10 billion a year on the budget.
And I'd just like to underline that point. The impact of reforming negative gearing and capital gains would be not that housing prices fall, but that they grow more slowly. Is that more accurate?
Yeah, that's right. I don't think anybody wants to see... Well, no, that's not true. I have a few younger friends who don't have property who would love to see house prices crash. But being a property owner myself with a mortgage, I don't think there's anybody that really wants house prices to crash. And the reason is even though if you don't have a house, it's a bad idea, if house prices crash, it flows through to the economy, and what we see is we see unemployment rise, we see people have less secure jobs, they lose their jobs, so it makes the economy a worse place. But certainly what we need to do is we need property prices to slow right down. They need to grow by less than wages. You know, the government's trying to make affordable housing a big issue at the next budget. Really, we can test whether or not this is successful. If the year after this, property prices grow faster than wages, they failed. If they grow less than wages, they've succeeded. And that really should be the standard that they're held to.
What are your kids locked out of the housing market?
Yes.
Well, you should shell out for them. You should support them, wealthy man like you.
That's been episode 18 of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute on May 8th, 2017. For a deeper dive into negative gearing, you can go back to episode 3 of Follow the Money called Double Negative. All previous episodes are available at our website at tai.org.au/podcasts. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to your favourite podcasts. And please, if you enjoy this podcast, rate and review us because it helps other people to find us. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm on Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Matt is at Matt Grudnoff, GRUDNOFF. Rod is R_O_D_C. And the Twitter handle for the Australian Institute is the Oz Institute with an AUS. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and our title music was composed by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. This week, we'll be bringing you our special Pocket Money episode on the 2017 federal budget, with all the best analysis from the Australia Institute straight from the budget lockup. Thanks for listening.